Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017. And this is another night. I've got four hangouts coming up. Hold on a second, I'll tell you what they are. Red Ice are up in 2 hours from now, and then Professor Mike Isaacson 2 hours later, and then 2 hours after that, Steve Franson to take us into Christmas Day. But first is Mimetic Animal. This is, as I say, number 54. So welcome to the channel, Mimetic.
Hi, Wells. Thank you for having me. Thanks for having me on Millennial this year. It's been a great season, I think, so far.
Oh yeah, I think it's gone well. I'm quite worn out at this stage, but there are three nights left. So yeah, it seems to have done good for the community. So I'm glad to have done it. So so tell people you're on minds.com. Why don't you tell people about the nature of minds.com, because it is quite different from other things, isn't it?
Yeah. Minds is an alt media, a new alt media site, new social media site that one of its primary advantages, I'd say, over perhaps Facebook or Twitter, is that it's really learnt lessons from those social media outlets over the years. So it's managed to amalgamate a lot of the characteristics and features that they have. And it's also the founder of that site, Bill, is a big free speech guy. So it's very, very dedicated to free speech, which is great.
That's similar to Gab in that sense. But what is the format of Minds? I mean, did it start about a year ago? I can't remember when it started, but people started talking. I started hearing about it about a year ago.
Yeah, I myself got into it through Dave Cullen's video on alt media. I don't know if you remember it when he was introducing.
I do. Yeah, I actually got the impression somehow that he was the guy behind Minds, but apparently he isn't.
No, it's a guy called Bill Ottman who designed the whole of Minds. Still in beta, so there's still some little bugs here and there, but it works pretty good. Basically, with Minds, like I said, they've amalgamated a lot from all the other features that other sites have in Facebook, like kind of groups. There's groups on there. There's a kind of news feed that you have, very similar to Facebook, but it's like audio, video.
And video. There's a limit of 30 minutes. So if a video of mine is less than 30 minutes long, then I put it up there. So it's a strange platform, to be honest. It feels very, as you said, like an amalgamation of different things. And one thing I would like them to do is have some sort of pro service so that you could get longer than 30-minute videos, because then I would feel more at home there. You know, just now it feels like somewhere where I just sort of dip in and out now and then.
I think one of the things that really gets people as well is the point system. I don't know if you're aware of how much you're aware of that.
I've seen it, but I don't know how it works. If you can explain it, that would be useful for people.
Yeah, it's the kind of gamification of social media, I believe, is the term they use. Basically, through using Minds, you accumulate points. You get 50 points for every hour that you're on there. For posting, you get points. And people can trade points and whatnot. And you use these points to boost your content, basically your posts, your content, beyond your subscriber base. So it'll appear right in people's feeds as they're going on, or maybe in the sidebar or something like that. So you can appeal to a lot more people than simply the people
So it sort of buys you recommendations or recommendation placement in other people's.
No, it'll come directly into people's feeds.
Yeah, right, I see. I didn't know that. I always wondered what was going on with the point system.
I think it gets a lot of people when they go straight, when they go on there, I think they get a bit confused. Perhaps it's not explained as well as they could have, but it's a good system when it's there, because I think it to a certain extent, it's a system that avoids a echo chamber, because you're always going to be reaching out beyond the people that subscribe to you.
Yeah, definitely. So why don't we talk about you and your work then now? Because is there a reason that, what kind of things do you make?
I mainly write blogs on the on Minds from a kind of identitarian, kind of maybe a little libertarian perspective, really trying to explore identity, really, and what identity means to us in current year. So I've done a lot of blogs about individualism, communitarianism, and like I say, kind of anti-white animosity in the culture at large.
Mm. I'm guessing that you're from the northwest of England.
I'm from the north of England, yeah.
Right, yeah. And that is traditionally very socialist. I mean, I'm interested in how you've arrived at these ideas growing up in that environment.
Well, yeah, I came from, and still live in to a certain extent, I think I grabbed the tail end of the working class, white working class community in the north of England. To be honest, I think the working class communities are dead where I am. They're practically dead. They're on their arse basically now, I think. But
how do you mean dead? Do you mean that people are becoming middle class or going into the underclass or being replaced?
All three, I'd say. I think a lot of people that have done well from the education system, you know, they did their A-levels and they went to uni and stuff like that. They've moved away from the area, so they've all gone out to middle-class areas. A lot of people have gone into welfare dependency and into the underclass, which is really not what the spirit of that working-class community was about. And then increasingly, yeah, they've been replaced by immigrants and migrants that have been, you know, slowly growing from their own areas into white working class areas.
Well, absolutely. This is a huge thing about the northern, the ex-industrial towns. They're now, and someone, I mentioned this in another hangout like a week ago, and somebody mentioned that the Muslim immigrants, the Pakistani immigrants, were brought into those towns or invited into those towns in order to do the night work at the factories like 40, 50 years ago. And
I think so. Though they were, the north of England, especially, I'm from Yorkshire, so I'm in the Yorkshire, kind of Yorkshire region.
Right. So I'm sorry for thinking northwest. My accents are obvious. My knowledge of accents is obviously getting rusty. I'm sorry.
It's extreme. I'd say it was very, very, extremely segregated. I live not far from Rotherham, that area of the world, and you can see.
Yeah, I think anyone who's familiar with my channel will have heard of Rotherham.
And that if you go to the market there, the old kind of working class market, it's almost so totally Asian now, and it's like walking into another world. You can go into there and it's like you hear the Asian music, the smells are different. You know, it's a different place from the English town, which is just around the corner. So it's incredibly segregated, I'd say, and it's kind of informal segregation. But I don't think anyone, when they were working in the night work, if that's true, they would have interacted at all.
Yeah, it would have been like a shadow community. Well, I say shadow community. I mean that metaphorically. A shadow community that would sort of come alive at night and, you know, go to that. And somebody was telling me about it, and they said, like, it was a memory of when they worked in factories back then. And you would finish it at 5 and you would be leaving at, you know, whatever, 6 o'clock, and you would see the night shift coming in. And then when you arrived in the morning, you would see the night shift leaving, and that was the only time you saw these ethnic minorities. It's amazing, really.
Yeah, it's a completely parallel societies, I'd say. And
yeah, that's the term I was thinking of. Yeah, parallel society. And now they've, you know, as we were saying, these, I guess a lot of these factories have closed down, and these people have created their own businesses, and thus driven out the working class whites who used to be. So those towns have become ethnic ghettos.
Yeah, and they're in, and they're increasing as well. More and more areas, and whites are being pushed more and more outwards to the outer, to the more kind of suburban and rural areas, I'd say. It's growing all the time as well.
It's definitely a strange thing. Of course, with our current political paradigm, there is no way to object to this because, you know, they're paying tax and they're obeying the laws, and we voted for it, and, you know, everyone keeps voting for it, apparently. So there is nothing, there is no way to object to this radical change of the society.
No, and they've been, they're intentionally, working class protest against it has always been sat on by the Labour Party as well, that the working class keeps voting for every time, which is annoying. And especially the kind of local authorities in the Yorkshire region. They have these little fiefdoms where...
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, they've been... I mean, I remember my family... like I said, I'm from the working class community in Yorkshire, and it was staunchly Labour-like. They hated Tories. Tories were basically the scum of the earth. But every, especially when Tony Blair came in, because it's what I remember. It's when I remember when Tony Blair came in, there was celebrations and stuff like that. It just seems so sad now when I think about how Tony Blair and New Labour sort of acted totally against their interests.
They completely betrayed the working class. I mean, this was a big thing with that. It was called the New Left. I think New Labour was really the first New Left political party, certainly in Britain. And it's definitely the first New Left government in Britain. Mm. And some people thought that it was still socialism or old left style socialism, or at least that it would still have those sympathies. But it didn't at all. I mean, the working class meant nothing to the likes of Tony Blair.
No, I think the Labour Party, ever since it was founded in, what was it, the late 19th century, early 20th century, was an alliance of...
I think it was about 1920, but that... I can't remember. Anyway, at the start of the 20th century.
Yeah. It was always an alliance, I think, of progressive intellectuals and the working class. And that was always a tension within that political party, but I never knew they would have betrayed them so terribly. I think the working class communities completely misjudged the progressive intellectuals about who they were and what they were. They were ignorant about that, I think. But the working class communities were egalitarian, but they're also kind of communitarian. They had traditional values, very Christian, even a little Christian, even when I was growing up there. And that was total odds to the rubbing the rights nose in diversity kind of attitude of New Labour, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about the Christianity is interesting, because I think that is something that, if you're well off, you can kind of do without religion to some extent. Certainly a well-off community can do without religion. It can get by. But I think for the working class, religion is much more of a pressing need, because it binds people together and gives them a sense of the light at the end of the tunnel, and so on. Something that was very interesting when I was researching the Rotherham scandal, and I don't want to go on about Rotherham, but something that was very interesting is that I couldn't find any mention of the churches. Because there are a dozen churches in that town, and yet none of them seem to have done anything about the child grooming. It's like they've been completely and utterly defanged.
Yeah, it was such a big part of the those communities as well, like kind of the Church of England and all the Protestant churches as well were a big part, maybe Catholic too in some areas, but it was a big part of that social life. I mean, I can remember in my community school in like, what was it, mid-90s or something like that, they'd still collect tin cans at Harvest Festival for pensioners and poor people and stuff like that. It did foster a great community spirit, but that's been traded for, you know, 0 hours contracts and consumerism and all that kind of, the atomized society. But it's totally lost now. I mean, I went to church maybe a year or two ago. There were about six people in there. But they used to be.
Wow, that's terrible.
I remember when
that's I was terrible.
It was full, near enough. As I remember, I was only small, but as I remember, it was quite full. But and now you've got a lot of A, depression, B, substance misuse of some one kind or another. And I think those communities have just been destroyed, absolutely deracinated.
Yeah, it is a very complicated issue because there's a guy on my channel, he's very staunchly working class, but also staunchly Thatcherite, and he thinks that when the mines closed, she was right to, like... He thinks that she shouldn't have done more to help the working class towns, that they should have done it. They should have helped themselves and, you know, pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and dealt with it themselves. And I can't help thinking that that was just not going to, that was never going to happen. It seems to me.
I'm actually, you know, I went through a bit of a kind of libertarian stage where I consciously rejected the kind of attitude that I grew up with, and I felt a bit resentful for a while, actually, about that community. You know, you have mixed feelings about the community that you're from, and the helplessness, the dependency, really started to disgust me at one point. But I don't know. I think it's really complicated.
It is very complicated. I mean, it's easy to feel disgust and to think, why don't you just sort yourselves out? But the thing is, these, you know, people are very complicated, and they're very susceptible to the signals going on around them, and the attitudes going on around them. And I think in the case of the British working class, and this definitely also applies to the Scottish working class as well, I think they need leaders. And if they don't have that, they are a tremendous force of energy, but if they don't have leaders, all of that energy just gets wasted. They languish. They rot. And I think that's what happened. And I don't know. I think in a way they're very easy to abuse. I mean, look at what the Labour Party have done to them. They just lead them like lambs to the slaughter. It's disgusting.
Yeah, it is disgusting. It's a difficult thing with the working class communities. I think you're right to say they were easily led. They became so dependent on the Labour Party out of a kind of irrational fear of the Tory Party from some sort of ancestral memory of Victorian slums, and the Labour Party uses that all the time to get their votes. You know, they're going to take away all your workers' rights and they even use that for the European Union now. They use the European Union as a kind of stick to beat the Tories with. It's like, they're going to take away all the rights that the EU has gotten you, as if the EU, it's like deigned these workers' rights onto the working class communities of Britain.
Yeah, and it's laughable. I mean, people had loads of rights before we joined the EU. It's not even that long ago that we joined the EU. I think it was 1973.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
Voted against it.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I was getting to, the Brexit referendum, because that showed that they do know what's going on. You know, the working class in the north of England, they do know they have some idea of the situation, like globalization, mass immigration, and politicians who are distant from them and don't care about them. So they are aware of the place that the EU has in their lives, in their society's life, and they voted to get rid of it, to be free of it. And I think the interesting thing about this is that it showed that they will vote for the EU at general elections because they can't vote for the Labour Party without voting for the EU as well. Hmm. But if you separate the EU from the Labour Party with a referendum, then they will vote against the EU. So in fact, their interests are not really, they don't have the same interest as the Labour Party that they vote for. You know, if you separate the party from the issues, then they vote against the party.
Yeah, definitely. The thing about the EU, I think what many working class people maybe picked up was that the whole point of the EU is to go above the people, is to like kind of elude democracy or any kind of, because the horrible masses might be, you know, racist or homophobic or whatever. And I think they caught onto that. I think the Leave campaign in that referendum did a good job of getting through to people that it was taking back control rather than having bureaucrats make decisions for them. And I think the Leave campaign was quite good at getting that across. What was the tagline? It was, you know, taking back control or something like that, wasn't it?
Yes, I can't remember now. That's the thing. The Leave campaign was actually very well done. It was a very good campaign, and they handled it well because it could so easily have gone the other way. And again, I think, if I recall correctly, it's difficult now to remember it separately from the US election, but I think I'm right in saying that up until the last minute, they thought that Remain would win, and then they were shocked by the result.
Yeah, didn't Nigel Farage came out, didn't he? And a few hours before the final result was declared, and almost conceded defeat, and that he was going to fight another referendum afterwards. And then it turned out he won. I think that they were just so taken by surprise with it as well. The Westminster,
everyone was to watch. Oh yeah, I mean it was fantastic. It was really wonderful that night. As I recall, I woke up. Some people were asking me to do an all-night hangout. And I thought, no, it's just going to be too depressing. It's just, we're going to just be sort of marinating in this failure and this loss. But then I went to bed. But then I woke up at like 3:30 or something, and I decided just to get out of bed and look at the BBC website to see what was going on. And, you know, it looked like we were going to win. So at that point I started a hangout, and then we stayed up till, I don't know, 7 or 8 in the morning as the results came in. And yeah, we fucking won. It was a really joyous night.
Yeah. I put 20 quid on for us to win that, and I won. I forgot what the odds were now. I wanted to keep the betting slip, but the guys at the betting shop wouldn't let me keep it. But I just had a feel. I thought at that time, I just had a feel for that people were just going to reject it in a lot of these working class. Because it was mainly England that that tipped it the other way. Because it was pretty close anyway. But I think it was kind of...
it definitely wasn't England. Scotland. Yeah, it does seem to have been, yeah, I mean, Scotland, and especially Edinburgh, I think Edinburgh voted something like 75% for Remain. It was one of the highest Remain areas in Britain. But yeah, I think the Brexit vote really came, as I recall, I mean, this is like a year and a half ago now, definitely from the working class north of England, and I think also from the sort of home counties areas, but obviously not from London. Mm-hmm. Because that's a completely different matter. So, all right, shall we talk more about your work? Because I want people to sort of have an introduction to... before we get to that, we were also going to talk about the switch from civic nationalism to ethno-nationalism, which you have made this year, and quite a lot of other people have made this year. Now, I would obviously like to think that that was partly due to my efforts, but obviously that's not quite true, because there is just a general surge of nationalism going on, and nationalism is, you know, the stronger form of nationalism is ethno-nationalism. So it's just kind of happening. But I'd like to hear from your point of view, why did you make that switch?
I think you're being a bit too modest there. It was actually some of your videos that tipped me over onto a more kind of more white identity politics kind of framework. You have strange, before you get that final ethno red pill, you're kind of wavering, and there's lots of indoctrinated resistances that you have within yourself against it. You make excuses and things like that, but I think people are waking up to the realization that the rules of the game have changed, that a kind of simple individualism just won't work in, or it'll lead to our eventual destruction.
It will, as a people, it will lead to our destruction. As a set of ethnic groups in Britain, or one ethnic group, however you want to classify that, we will absolutely be destroyed by civic nationalism, you know, as in every country. And then we will not be destroyed as individuals. There will not be an old style genocide or massacre of us, but as a group, we will be destroyed. So I wouldn't shy from that word, honestly.
I think, I don't know if you saw the interview that Faith Goldie did with the guys called,
Students for Western Civilization.
Yeah, and the guy described it as ethnocide, which the way he described it was that we were slowly being sidelined within our own countries and stuff like that. I think that's a bit of a better term than, you know, the old kind of white genocide kind of term, because I think he was right in that video when he said people are going to be a bit nonplussed when you say, you know, we're being genocided, no one's been.
Yeah, you know, because people, even if it does fit the UN definition, I think it's number C or something, most people do not have that. It doesn't match most people's idea of genocide. Hmm. So to use it is to ask to be laughed at, even if it is, strictly speaking, true. It's a sort of losing battle. And so I think ethnocide probably is a better word, because apart from anything else, it's intriguing. You know, people have never heard that word before. Mm. I'd never heard it before until like a month ago or something. So I think people will ask, well, what is that? I think it's useful to us.
Yeah, I think that he seemed to have some real clear thinking as well. I was impressed by that interview on that guy's channel, actually. They were really good, but I think, yeah.
Did you see him going on the audio from his interview with some college professors? He's a very intelligent guy. Oh, yeah. You should have a look at his channel.
I know a lot of people have made the jump from civic nationalism and to a more ethnic-centered nationalism or identity politics, whatever you might want to call it. And I think it is because people are coming to the realization that, I think, first of all, that the rules of the game are changing. In a multicultural society, it seems inevitable that you're going to have competing groups and collective politics, competing for resources, because there's always going to have to be, in a multicultural society, it seems to me, there's always going to have to be a central authority that manages all the different cultures and ethnic groups, and they're always going to be competing for the favor of that central authority. I wouldn't want European people to become kind of dependent upon some kind of super state or anything like that. But it seems inevitable that you're going to have competition between groups in a multicultural society. And also, I think people are missing. I mean, this might feed back into what we were saying about the working class communities. People are, like you've said many times, atomized, depressed, stressed, without any community sense of belonging to something greater than themselves or to some kind of something, beautiful and beyond themselves.
They're separated from their nation, from their people, and even increasingly from their communities, their local communities. Yeah. Because, well, I don't know, why do you think that is? Why would you say that is? Like specifically the local community.
The local community. So I can only speak from my own perspective. I think in the working class communities that I grew up in, I think a lot of it's got to do with the economic changes that happened with those communities, the dependence on the state instead of the actual community itself. People have become much more introverted in a sense. They live their own private lives and they don't interact with each other. We're talking about church and Christian community. All that seems to have gone away. I'm not quite sure the reasons for that, but there's a sort of cynicism, like a deep-seated cynicism in Western cultures, I think, about the neighbour next up. I suppose it's part of the decline, isn't it? The decline of the urban decline and stuff like that. But I'm not quite sure the exact reason why people don't. There isn't those social bonds anymore. Not sure.
I think part of it has to be technology. You know, the fact that you can do so much from your house, actually just sitting still in one place, and you can do all of these different things, up to, like, even shopping, you know, banking, all of that, endless entertainment, endless discussion if you're into that, and also social interaction with other people, you know, with virtual friend. And I mean, I've had very deep friendships entirely over the internet, and it's kind of weird to think of people that I've never actually physically met. So it's a real thing, but I think it does also detach people from their local community, what's going on around them. And because you're getting some kind of social interaction. Now, I think for a lot of people now, especially young men, it's games, it's gaming over the internet. And I think that just swallows up massive amounts of time.
Yeah, and this is also something I've written about in some of my blogs. There's a strange solipsism that's come over, like, Western man. I wrote a blog called The Poor Man's Individualism, a critique of libertarianism through communitarianism. Basically, in the kind of libertarian neoliberal view of the individual, you're kind of a solipsistic, atomized individual that is totally free but has nothing to do, can do whatever they want but has no effect on it. And my contention was in that blog that it's only through a kind of communitarianism and a kind of identitarianism that you can have a real individualism. What's the point of individualism if you can't have an effect on other individuals? You just
that's a good point.
Lost in space.
It's the difference between individualism and atomized individual, where there is just no connection. There's no sort of organic, joyous connection with other people. That's what I would just, and well, that's one characteristic of atomized individual. Another one, it would be that you have no guidance. in the sort of broad sense, and also in the broad sense, you're very disconnected. This was the NPI speech last year that I gave, was really about a young woman, I think she's 19, in America, who was completely disconnected from her people, from her race, and was just thinking about herself. And, you know, it's incredibly depressing because there are all these systems in place to allow her to do that and to allow her to make money doing that and so on. So she can have what she thinks is a full life. But it's a life of just selfishness and sensations and distractions.
Yeah, it's a delusion, I think. But it's a delusion that's been created, I think, through lots of ideological propaganda, indoctrination. These systems exist to allow people, and that's part of social liberalism, I suppose, in that it gives people the positive rights to become free and become who they are. And I suppose it feeds into the SJW thing about, you know, your personal identity because you're a, you know, was it a lesbian, transgender, disabled person or whatever, that's defines who you are. Rather than any kind of real context that you're in, real interactions that you have, it's this.
Well, indeed, I mean, this is how you end up with it. Yeah. This is how you end up with the other kin thing, which is the most extreme example of it. But it's real. You know, it is actually a real thing. There are people doing it. But that's that is the most extreme. But there are sort of less extreme examples of the same thing, which is just this, I think, a real search for identity in a world that doesn't give them one. And that's the thing. People do need to be guided in that sense. They do need to be told, here's what you are, here's what you need to do in order to enact that thing that you are. And here are the rewards. Here's the social system in place to facilitate you being that thing, playing out that role. And that's not the end of the world. And if you've got some ideas in other directions, it's not the end of the world that you can't live those out, you know, for the vast majority of people, I think.
Yeah, definitely. But I think it's certainly in people's interests that they... I was impressed by a speech by Richard Spencer. I don't agree with everything that Richard Spencer espouses or anything like that, but I think it was in a speech he said that your identity, our identity, is something that is dangerous to quote-unquote them. And I think there's a huge bureaucratic system in place squatting like a big toad over it all. And lots of people making loads and loads of money and feeling very, very important through this whole kind of ideological system that keeps people atomized and alienated from what should be an organic life.
Yeah. And I think that we do need to make moves in that direct, like back to that. And I obviously you can't go back in time, but I think we can recreate, in our context, the British village, the English village, the Scottish village. We can do that. And I think that one of my previous guests was talking about this, that new technologies will actually facilitate that. So we're not going, I don't think we need to continue living in this way. And I don't think that we will. But anyway, so to move on to another subject, you also wanted to talk about the art world and modern society. Would you describe yourself as an artist?
Yeah, I'm a real life artist and everything. I've got a studio. I usually make sculptures, paintings, in a kind of traditionalistic kind of way. But obviously, I try to imbue it with my own experience. This goes back to the story about working class communities and stuff like that. I was desperate to escape when I was 18, 19. The kind of place that I grew up in at that time. I love the English working class, but they're pretty narrow minded, and I was desperate to escape that.
Could you talk about why? And I don't want to. I'm just saying this out of genuine curiosity, and because I think other people will be interested as well. Can you explain why you were desperate to escape that? What was it that you were desperate to escape?
I suppose, in a sense, it was. Maybe it feeds into what we're saying about the kind of materialistic and it's difficult to put your finger on. I'd say it was the narrow horizons of that community, even though no, it's really difficult to say why I wanted to leave that community. I suppose I've always been a bit of an outsider anyway. But I just desperately wanted to escape the whole kind of grind of life in that part of the world where, you know, in my secondary school, there were still the same people that, you know, apprenticeships were basically the only way you could advance in the world and stuff like that. There was no real ambition or aspiration. I think that's a big problem with working class communities. Like your friend said about the Thatcherite vision and stuff like that. He's got a point there, I think. There is a lack of aspiration in those communities. And I just wanted to...
Yeah, but that's the problem. You know, if there is a lack of aspiration, then you can't expect them to aspire. You know, you can expect them to collapse. That's the trouble.
Yeah, it's a vicious circle. But anyway, I wanted to get out of there, and then I went to art college, which is I love art. It's what I've always done since I was a small child. It's part of my life. But when you go to an institution like the modern art college today, that was a red pill moment with the kind of conceptual art practice that's pushed onto people there. You're literally pushed away from traditional art forms, traditional ways of that people in Western societies have done for thousands of years, into, you know, mucking around with conceptual art and stuff like that. You really are pushed. I know you've been to art college. I don't know if you probably went a bit before me, but I don't know what your experiences were.
Well, I can't paint or draw, and I can't sculpt. So I was never, you know, I was never there to do that kind of thing. Hmm. I don't really know why I was there, really. I thought I would meet interesting people. That was definitely part of it.
Yeah, that's part of it for me as well. I was disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah. So the point is that I never was there to do classical or traditional art, and therefore I was never steered away from doing classical or traditional art. But I do know that I didn't see any there. I didn't like at the degree shows and so on. There was never anything like that at the exhibitions throughout the year. Nothing like that. So I can only imagine that they must have been actively steering these painters and sculptors away from doing anything like that. And that was that was at two different art colleges, one of them in London, one of them in the northwest of England.
Yeah, they do actively push. If you go to art college today and you love drawing, you love painting, you love sculpting, they will. And it's part of the whole kind of art politics or art ideology that's in place within all of art schools internationally, I'd say. There's very few schools that aren't. And it's all about the conception of art. So they will push you into that way. And the whole system is molded to produce that kind of artist. The kind of the one where the actual art itself doesn't matter. It's just the kind of symbol of the quote unquote idea that we're all supposed to ponder over.
Yeah, it's very hollow.
Yeah, It is very hollow. People, I think people, they encounter a lot of contemporary art and they're baffled by it. They don't know what's going on. But that's precisely the effect that the artist wants. It's all about, it's a form of social constructivism. The whole conceptual art thing is part of social constructivism. It's precisely to question. They believe all that the art is basically a social construct like everything else, and that the whole, so they wish to turn art in on itself and sort of constantly question everything all the time. It's a kind of like anti-essentialism.
Yeah, the thing is, if you're constantly questioning things, then nothing is sacred and everything ends up being deconstructed. So it's a very strange and subtle trick that's played there. But it works very, very well because you have clever people, like clever young people, 18, 17-year-olds, who want to be clever. You know, they see themselves as clever. And I was one of them, and I met many others of them. And so you can flatter them into doing what you want by telling them, well, the clever thing to do here is to always ask questions. And we want to encourage you to always ask questions. And your work, your artwork, should encourage other people to always ask questions. Well, the trouble with that is you end up with, as I say, deconstruction of everything. And also no comfort, no reassurance, because the artwork can't do that. If it's supposed to be asking questions about things, then it can't approve of anything, any of those things that it's questioning. It must necessarily treat everything skeptically or even negatively.
Yeah, so the conceptual art is basically a negation. It's anti-art. It comes from the Dada movement in Switzerland after the war. It's a kind of pseudo-leftist kind of art movement, really, that rejected all of art, basically all of society, into kind of chaos and chance and indeterminacy. It had a certain amount of style to it. Surrealism came out of it, but it went through, and especially in the 60s with the Fluxus movement, and it's become embedded in the institutions. And it has got a left-wing attitude to it of constantly questioning everything being held up. No order, no essences, no everything's up in the air. And people are baffled by it, and that's precisely the point. It's supposed to be baffling you. It's part of the trick, really.
Yeah. It's very, in the end, it's very inhuman. It's very cold, but it's at least clever, you know. Well, it's clever in a particular way, you know. It's is it really clever to destroy the world around yourself? Probably not. But you know that is missed in the act of doing it in order to, you know, jerk off about how clever you are.
Yeah.
There was something else I was going to go into there, but I've now forgotten what it was. It was about I said something else about the deconstruction, but it's just gone out of my head. Okay, so is there anything else that you would like to talk about before we finish?
I don't know if you saw the Turner Prize this year. As far as anyone's interested in the Turner Prize, I think it sums it all up perfectly. Did you see that?
I believe that Morgoth tweeted about it, and it was some ridiculous. The thing that I saw, and this might not be the Turner Prize, but it's worth describing anyway. It was a sculpture of a black woman watching a white man with his penis being sucked up into a vacuum cleaner hose.
The artist that won it, the 2017 Turner Prize, which is a prize of, I think, £25,000, is a lady called Lubaina Himid, who moved to England from Zanzibar, Tanzania.
Oh, this sounds promising.
And it's basically, she's gone through all the colleges of art. She's been on all the art council committees, where they commissioned her own friends to, do commissions and everything for it. It's a really corrupt system, public funding for art in this country anyway. The artwork that won it was In the Name in the Money, cut off life-size figures of black servants and labourers who Hamid individualises, giving each them a name and a story to work against the sense of powerless mass. So I think it just sums it up perfectly, like kind of what's been replaced there with... and the artworks are just cut out black figures. That I suppose the idea behind it is that she's kind of giving a voice to these black figures that have really made the white man.
Oh God!
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. It's not even profound. It's fucking boring. It's banal. Yeah, it's in the end. It's just another thing about black people being oppressed by white people. Well, fucking great. You know, is that really the? It's so annoying. It's the same with these awful feminist artworks that you see, where it's just endless stuff about the vagina, and you know, like some woman doing something with her vagina as an installation, performance art piece, or it's endless visual variations of vaginas. It's very strange, you know. And I know that there are other examples of feminist art, but every time I see a fucking feminist artist now, it seems to be something about vaginas. You know, it's like how narrow their horizons must be, and how monotonous their obsessions must be, that every time they produce something, it just happens to be another fucking vagina. It's just ridiculous.
I think it's got a lot to. I think that's got a lot to do with the kind of the liberal middle class woman's own obsession and view of her own femininity. Basically, they've got a very same with that. What's she called? Lena Dunham. She's very strange. She's got a very strange relationship to her own body.
Oh God! Yeah.
But this is what. Sorry, this is what our society believes is top quality. Art. This is the imagination of our society. John Ruskin, the Victorian art critic, said that if he was to judge a culture, he wouldn't judge it by the philosophy or the literature or anything like that. He would look to the art, because I think things are clearly displayed there. That's what I think he meant by that. But what have we got for our art? You know, something about how we've been at other people, this kind of self-hatred, and the weird feminist artworks where they have this weird relationship to their own body, a reproductive system. It's really sad, especially from a culture like Britain that practically defined landscape painting, or you know, European civilization that produced people like Leonardo and Michelangelo and things like that. That's how far we've fallen,
and all the rest of them, and yet here we are now with this utter poison. It's just bullshit. But I mean, I think it's, you know, to end on a positive note, it doesn't have to be like this, and there is still a market for good traditional art, and there is still an interest in good traditional art. It's really just a matter of networking, building the networks. You know, plugging into the networks that already exist in order to find those things, meet other people who are into those things, and buy and sell those things. It does still happen. It's just not what you see on the Turner Prize or at the Tate Modern.
No, I'm optimistic as well about the internet in lots of ways. I myself as an artist, I'm trying to work out how I can get my art on the internet to the people that want to, you know, want to see it, want to appreciate it, hopefully want to buy it maybe, but I just wonder how it's going to, but I think there's some hope there for the internet, as it has done in many ways, kind of getting away from the institutions and straight into people's on people's phones and on people's laptops, where they have a chance to not be dominated by the Turner Prize or the mass media or anything like that. So I'm quite hopeful about the internet and for art's future there. And there is a lot of good artists around, but they don't get this. They're not celebrated the way they ought to be.
Yeah. In fact, the establishment art world tries to suppress them, or at least it ignores them. So yeah, this is just another reason why we have to work past the establishment and just create our own industries, and in this case, our own art world. And I think that so many people are completely baffled by the state of modern art, the establishment art world, that I think it's doable. I think there are enough people who would absolutely be interested in traditional art for, you know, current year, if they only knew that it existed and how to find it and how to find other people who are interested in it. Because obviously it's not just about the objects. It's not just about the sculptures or the paintings or whatever. It's also about the environment created by people who are into that sort of stuff and who go there to find, you know, solace and comfort.
Yeah, and you can get so much from art. And I think the movement, you can call it, or whatever you want to call whatever this is, I think it really needs to make its own distinct culture from the mainstream culture, and develop its own themes, its own ways of doing things, which can challenge and hopefully defeat the mainstream culture, which is absolutely, I mean, it's not going to be very difficult because the mainstream culture is absolutely terrible. But I think that's something that needs a bit more attention, actually, from my experience online, a bit more cultural. I think there's, well, a bit more cultural production. I think there is stuff like that coming on the way. I think there's some kind of like good music. Fashwave, vaporwave and stuff like that. That's a new kind of genre of music that's online that can't be incorporated into the mainstream culture. It's like a kind of the body of the mainstream culture just rejects it. So hopefully people will start to create their own cultural products, which will expand the whole identitarian cause in a way.
Oh, I think so. And I think it's really just a matter of people in general knowing where to go online. Like it shouldn't be too diffuse. It should be a small number of websites that regularly do this stuff, and so that the activity can be concentrated in a small number of places, and then people will know to go to those places, and it will be reliable and consistent. And also, I think there needs to be pressure on people to actually do stuff, to do things, like to keep these websites going. And, you know, meetups, exhibitions, that sort of thing. So there's a lot that can be done and that should be done, but people need to realize their own agency, their own ability to influence things, because I think that is a problem. You know, we've been too accustomed to the establishment in whatever sector taking care of things. Well, actually, obviously not taking care of things, but controlling things. And it's now we have a chance to do better. So I hope we do. All right, so let's end it there. This has been Mimetic Animal. You can find him on minds.com. And is there anything else you'd like to say before we finish?
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. I hope the rest of Millennial goes okay. It's been a great season of live streams. Thank you.
Oh, thanks very much. Okay, and I'll be back in about an hour with Red Ice. So I'll see you then. Bye-bye for now.